Mike, well, we're continuing our sponsorship with Logos, and we want to thank them for sponsoring our show. And briefly, we want to talk about their Logos package. And Mike, can you tell us a little bit about Logos? You would be the best man in the room to talk about it.
I think it's the preeminent Bible software. But what it really is fundamentally two things. Logos is both a library, full digital library. They have over 200,000 digital books, you know, a whole range of publishers, anything from self-published items all the way to high-end academic publishers like Oxford and Cambridge. So it's fundamentally a library. And then the other thing it is a set of databases. And this is where you get your original language research tools that in Logos you can use directly through English, through the power of what we call reverse interlinears. And there's just nothing else like it on the planet. I mean, I can honestly say that. It has no equivalent among its competitors.
Yeah, and if you want to go deeper into the word, Logos is the Bible study platform for you. I mean, it fuses powerful technology with biblical resources. You got Bible search tools, commentary, seminary-level courses, and even audiobooks right on your phone, tablet, or desktop. I mean, they offer nearly 200,000 digital books. You know, the technology is amazing. You know, Mike, you've demonstrated it several times throughout the years on how you use it. And really, if you want to do Bible study, you got to have tools like this.
Yeah, I mean, a practical illustration of this would be, let's say you have a few hundred books at home, you know, in your Bible study library. Well, not all those books have indexes. You don't know if those books discuss the verse you're looking at unless you go back and look at the index. But then look at all the time you're spending. You got to leaf through and find the indexes. Then you got to go page through to the verse reference. And the books that don't have indexes, you're stuck. You have no idea whether that particular book discusses what you're looking at all. But with Logos, everything is digital and it's instantaneously searchable by verse reference, by word, by phrase, you know, even, again, different languages. If you're in a biblical database, again, you don't have to even know Greek and Hebrew to tap into it. There's really, again, I keep saying it, nothing else like it on the planet, but that's because that's true. There isn't anything like it.
Yeah, like you mentioned, you don't have to know Greek or Hebrew. It'll even help you pronounce the words. I mean, did they hire people to actually say every word in Greek and Hebrew, Mike?
Yes, we did.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes, we did. There's a lot that goes into it, you know, under the hood that people never see. But it's just being able to just do something as simple as type a verse reference into passage guide or use something called the fact book. Just type a verse reference in and hit enter. You know, it's that simple. But what it does is it combs through everything you've got in your system, and you can tailor your system to have it only search certain things, have it search certain things certain ways. Again, it's a personal research assistant right on your desktop or on your phone or on your tablet. There's just nothing like it.
Logos is now more affordable than ever. Get started for just $49. Go to logos.com/nakedbible. And we want to thank Logos for sponsoring the Naked Bible Podcast.
You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heise's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 441, The Afterlife, Part 2, with Dr. Justin Bass. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Doing pretty well, you know, all things considered. So heading into radiation treatments for my tumor. So we'll keep everybody posted on how that goes.
Yes, please do. Yep. Please do. And that's going to go on for 3 weeks, you said, right? The whole month of September.
Yeah.
So end of September, hopefully we should know something, you think?
Yeah, well, I would hope so, you know, one way or the other, that it did its job or it didn't. They tend to be pretty cautious, so it may take a little longer than that. But they'll probably want me to get another MRI before they start really assessing anything. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, prayers are continued. Well, Mike, this is a big weekend. Also, we have our fantasy draft this weekend. So I just want to wish you good luck. Hope
bad luck.
Yeah, bad luck. I hope you do bad. I hope it's a horrible year for you.
Hope you draft all the guys that are going to get injured. Yeah.
I hope Aaron Rodgers does horrible. Packers are bad.
He's going late in drafts. I've done a number of mock drafts. Have you done any practice drafts?
No, still have not done any. You know, I don't like that because I get stuck on my, you know, players I like. So I like just the chaos going fresh. So I have done zero.
Yeah.
Going in blind.
I've done enough to know pretty much where everybody's going to go. So
so you're saying late rounds, Rodgers.
Not that it really helps. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What about Mahomes?
Yeah, Rodgers is going late.
Is everybody jumping on Mahomes early? Too early?
No, he's Mahomes is the QB2 in ADP. I'm sure our audience is just loving all the these acronyms now for fantasy football, but he's the second quarterback that gets taken off the board typically. But Josh Allen's first.
Mahomes just got inducted to the Texas Tech Red Raiders Hall of Fame, so
he deserves it. I'll be excited if half my team doesn't get hurt again. Like last year, it was just a disaster.
Well, at least we don't have to deal with the COVID protocols. That made it unbearable, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, that was bad.
You could almost say it was hell. Since we're talking about hell.
I see what you did there. Yeah, I see what you did there.
Got my segue there? Yeah, well, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll live with it. Okay, we'll live with it.
So the first episode was great, talking about the afterlife and all that stuff. And then we continue the conversation this week.
Yep, get into some New Testament vocabulary and expand on the discussion. So, yeah, I thought the first part was good. Second part, I expect it'll be the same and it'll be informative. Well, we're happy once again to have Justin Bass with us. Dr. Bass was with us in a previous episode talking about biblical terms for the afterlife, you know, both good and bad, mostly bad the first time around. but we got into some of the other cosmic geographical terminology. We're going to continue that discussion this time. But again, for the sake of people who have not listened to part one yet, and I highly recommend before even listening to this one that you go listen to part one. But in case not, I'm going to ask Justin to briefly introduce himself and then we'll jump right into it. So Justin, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, it's been great having this discussion. And just a little bit about myself again. The Lord opened my eyes to himself over 20 years ago now, 2001. I was in college and God gave me a hunger for his word and for apologetics, for theology, and threw me into seminary, Dallas Theological Seminary, and did a THM and a PhD. And since then, I planted a church and taught at various schools and did mission work in the Middle East and written a few books, one on the resurrection and my dissertation, which is a lot about what we're talking about, got published called The Battle for the Keys. I actually have a chapter in that book that talks about these different compartments that we're talking about, Hades and Sheol and the Abyss and Tartarus and Gehenna and the Lake of Fire and Abraham's bosom and paradise and third heaven and just all these fascinating terms of the cosmic geography, the unseen realms geography that we have from the scriptures. I get into in that book, so y'all can go, those listening can go deeper in there in the battle for the keys.
But, yeah, we've referenced that book before again in our own series on Revelation. I do highly recommend it. It's an academic work, but that's not going to scare people in this audience. It's quite a good book, very interesting. Again, focused on the keys passages in the book of Revelation, but you do pick up on a lot of this stuff, which is why the way I preface this in part one of our discussion was I get questions a lot on old, not only Old Testament, but Old and New Testament afterlife vocabulary. Hey, what's Gehenna? What's the Lake of Fire? Is that the same as Tartarus? Is that the same as the Abyss? What's Sheol, you know, all this sort of stuff. So when I sort of got it in my head that, you know, this is really worth some podcast time, I thought right away of Justin Bass, and that's why he spent the previous episode with us talking about this vocabulary and where we're going to resume it here. But Justin has spent a lot of time, devoted a lot of time, and certainly in writing has devoted, you know, considerable space to, you know, to discussing all this stuff. So he's sort of the perfect person to have back on. So Justin, thanks for coming back on. And we might as well just jump right into Gehenna. Again, for those of you who haven't listened to part one, you really need to do that, because we're not going to rehearse part one and part two. I mean, I'm sure there'll be some overlap, but part one, we talked about Sheol and Hades and the Abyss and Tartarus, and we might as well just jump right into Gehenna. So what's Gehenna? I mean, where does the term come from? All these sorts of questions.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit in part one about how some of the translations of the English translations of the Bible are very misleading. And I even have before me right now a great example. You know, the NASB, I'm sure you agree, is, you know, one of the most wooden literal translations. And I'm you know, a huge fan of the NASB. You know, if I'm struggling with any passage in the original language, I'm going to grab the NASB and see what it's saying. But even the NASB on 2 Peter 2:4 translates Tartarus there as hell. So just why did they do that? Why did they translate that hell? I got to find the person translating
to give
that.
You something to write about later.
Yeah, exactly. So, and this happens a lot. You know, you have the same in Luke 16. We talked about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And when it says the rich man lifted up his eyes in hell, a lot of translations will put hell there, even though in the Greek, again, it's Hades. And it's not referring to what we would call the future eternal place of punishment, which the primary term for that in the New Testament, mainly on the lips of Jesus, is Gehenna. So when we talk about Gehenna, we're basically talking about what we would say is the future hell. And interestingly, there's no one in Gehenna right now. You know, no souls, no resurrected bodies. Gehenna is an empty place that is prepared for the devil and his angels.
So it's an eschatological place.
It's an eschatological realm that will in some way be parallel to the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem, as pictured in Revelation. Because as we'll talk about, I think the lake of fire imagery in Revelation is the same as Gehenna. We see some very key parallels between the two conceptually in the New Testament. But Gehenna, you know, the background of it, again, it's an actual place. You know, the it's really the Valley of Hinnom, which is
Gehenna. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it just became, you know, this word Gehenna, but really it goes back to Hinnom, the Valley of Hinnom, which is a place that, as far as the Old Testament's concerned, is a place where a lot of wicked evil things happened, especially with certain kings like Manasseh is said to have sacrificed children there. And this just seemed to be one of those places that a dark place where I'm sure demons were heavily inhabiting because of so much evil practices that were being done there. And, you know, whether polytheistic or whether idolatry or actual, you know, physical sacrifices, all kinds of things you can read about in 2 Kings 23,
yep,
in Jeremiah 7, just some key passages that talk about it. But that seems to be the background, and that's why Gehenna became the for the Jewish world, this became the key term for the eschatological hell to come because of all the wickedness that happened in this place.
I have the Jeremiah passage here in front of me. I'll just read it for our audience just so they can fix this in their minds. They have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom. So you have Valley Gay, and then Hinnom is the term there. Gay Hinnom is where Gehenna comes from. To burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will be no Tophet, or the valley of slaughter, so forth. But I mean, it's a very dark place. I mean, just to put it mildly.
Yes. And again, this is the key term that Jesus used. I believe it's used 12 times in the New Testament. 11 of the times is by Jesus. The 12 times is by his brother. So James uses it once in James 3. He's talking about the fact that the tongue is set on fire by Gehenna. So just a more of a, in a way of a metaphorical use of it. But the way Jesus uses it primarily is, this is where you who reject me, you who follow the path of wickedness, you who reject eternal life, this ultimately is where you will end up in the, and this is again where the fire imagery comes from. The imagery goes before Jesus, but Jesus consistently will use fire, the fiery Gehenna, describing it as a place of fire, but he also describes it as a place where, you know, where maggots are eating the flesh and things like that. So a lot of different imagery for just basically a horrific, you know, miserable existence.
Yeah, I mean, the fire, obviously, the most obvious reference there is, you know, like I just read, passing, you know, children through the fire. I mean, this whole Old Testament, not sanctioned by the Old Testament, obviously, but you read about it in the Old Testament, this practice in certain idolatrous contexts they were doing, you know, in this place, you know, child sacrifice and whatnot. So it's a place of death. It's a place of suffering. The death and the suffering was caused by the burning. So that's the most obvious reference. But you might want to comment on, you know, because there's a lot of either other information or some would say mythology that has sort of accrued to this about a garbage dump and so on and so forth. Do you have any opinion on that as far as the fire origin, the fire description of Gehenna?
Yeah, the idea of this garbage dump that's constantly on fire, I just haven't found the evidence for it. You know, it's just one of those things that, you know, you hear.
You know, a lot of other people.
Yeah, you hear a lot of sermon illustrations without citing the sources. This is like that great one with the high priest had that rope tied around his foot, you know, when he'd go Holy of Holies. And
I really want that to be.
I know that's one of those that we want to be true. Or like when St. Nicholas punched, who did he punch? He punched Arius, Santa Claus punching the heretic. You just want those stories to be true, but the evidence is just not forthcoming. So yeah, that's a common kind of myth on that.
We don't want anybody in the audience to misunderstand. I mean, Jesus isn't correct to invoke fire imagery here because you get it from the Old Testament.
And I would even say, you know, Isaiah, I think the seeds are there too, because you have that amazing parallel between the end of Isaiah and the end of Revelation, because you have the new heavens and the new earth in Isaiah 65. And then you have Isaiah ending on a real sour note with this fire that will not be quenched. And looking out at all the dead bodies and the maggots again and this unquenchable fire.
There's plenty of legit material, you know, to reference as far as the fiery descriptions. But I, like I said, I don't know where the garbage dump thing. I don't know how that all got started. But
yeah, I don't know the origin of it. That'll be interesting. I remember. I think it was. Harold Honer, the late great Harold Honer from Dallas Seminary. He was the kind of person that would find these things. He found the source material for the rope. I think that ultimate, the rope around the high priest's leg was some medieval Jewish writer. I can't remember the name, but I remember he found the source of that.
Yeah, that does sound like something he would do. He would spend time on. So why do you think uses the term?
Yeah, so I think, again, I don't think, just like Abraham's bosom and some of these other terms that we've talked about, I think in the imagery of the rich man and Lazarus in that parable, the cosmic geography, I don't think Jesus is being original here. I think he's using, you know, if he's going to describe this, you know, future place of punishment where the wicked will go, where the devil and his angels will go, he's going to use the language that they're mostly familiar with. And we do see that this imagery of, you know, this idea of Gehenna that goes back to this really hellish type of place that had all this wickedness. This was a common picture of that future place of punishment. And so Jesus is using that common idea again, he uses some other terms like eternal punishment. So one of the key places for a parallel for the lake of fire is his parable again in Matthew 25, where he says, you know, really fascinating. He says to the wicked, he says, you will be thrown into this fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And so it's really interesting because he says to the righteous, you know, you will come to the kingdom prepared for you. And so you have this image of the righteous, the kingdom is prepared for them, but the damned, hell is not prepared for them. It's prepared for the devil and the angels, and then they go there. And so I think maybe it's because Christ's redemption, his blood paid for all. And so no one need go there, but those who go there, kind of like C.S. Lewis says, you know, ultimately are rejecting. They're in a locked room, a room locked from the door inside. So I always found that difference there. If you put them right there parallel in Matthew 25, he doesn't say prepared for you when he speaks to the damned. He says prepared for he brings in the devil and his angels. And of course, the devil and his angels in Revelation 20 are thrown onto the lake of fire. Mm-hmm. And at the end of Matthew 25, they go to eternal punishment. I think a kolosson, the Greek word ion kolosson. So the eternal punishment versus the ion zoe, the eternal life.
You know, even with the lake of fire there in Matthew 25, verse 41, Matthew 25, 41, the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And then you get the lake of fire, you know, language in Revelation. I mean, Jesus is also, you know, dipping into familiar material there because, you know, like prepared for the devil and his angels. I mean, that's going to come from Enoch. And that's very Enochian in its description there. And there aren't too many descriptions like it, but yeah, I mean, the fact that Jesus would use some of this familiar language, I mean, shouldn't surprise anybody.
That's right.
I don't know why. I mean, some are troubled, you know, by this. I'm sure you know this well, that, well, you know, you guys are trying to bring in all this extra material in to understand the Bible. Yeah, because it's context. It's context. Why wouldn't you do that if it's good enough for the biblical writers, and in this case, it's good enough for Jesus to give us these contexts, then why shouldn't we mention them now?
Exactly. I mean,
it doesn't make any sense.
It's Peter bringing in Tartarus. I mean, the fact that again, Peter brings in Tartarus, or Paul quotes the Stoic philosophers, or, you know, or the Cretan, the lion
right.
from Titus. You know, again and again, we see the biblical authors using, and even going back to the Old Testament, using the ancient Near Eastern imagery to redeem it and to show it's a vehicle for the truth of biblical revelation, I think.
We should talk a little bit about, let's focus on the lake of fire. And I have some notes here about a background for that being Daniel 7, 9 and 10. So Daniel 7 is going to be real familiar to the people in this audience, but let's just get into that material a little bit.
Yeah, that's my thought too. It's, you know, it's only used, lake of fire is only used in Revelation 6 times. And even though it's parallel, it's conceptually paralleled with Gehenna or the eternal fire or eternal punishment, the different ways that Jesus is referring to it, that the imagery that John is probably going off of is this picture in Daniel 7, specifically verse 9 and 10. I'll read it from the NASB. He says, I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat and the books were open. And so you just have a lot of parallels there to that imagery in Revelation 20, because you have God seated on his throne, the books are open, it's judgment, angels are there. In Revelation 20, the resurrected righteous and wicked are there. Mm-hmm. And so I think this river of fire probably is what he's corresponding the ultimate place of punishment that people will be thrown if their names are not written in the book of life, the place prepared for the devil and his angels. this is that, you know, this is that.
Yeah, and you go back into Daniel 7 and who's being judged there? Well, it's the beasts, you know,
right?
The chaos monsters there.
Right.
So that would, again, it would make sense.
Verses 11 and 12. Yep. And then the kingdom that the Son of Man will have gives, you know, all kingdoms give way to his kingdom. And so you have the eternal lake of fire has basically inaugurated at that point at the end of Revelation 20. And then 21 and 22 is the kingdom of the Son of Man, the God becoming all in all. It's the new heavens and the new earth that begins and will never end.
So it's pretty clear you're taking the view that hell, the lake of fire, is eternal. Do you have any specific reasons for going that direction? I mean, I get this question a lot in Q&A, and I flip back and forth between the what I would call the traditional view, the eternal everlasting fire view, and annihilation, because in the tough part for me is the death of death. You know, and then you get in all these philosophical discussions. Well, if death is dead, well, then how can people still be dying? And, you know, it's kind of a weird discussion, but it's still one that arises from some of the language in the text. So can you say a little bit about your view there?
Yeah, I do take, trust me, if I could be convinced by, you know, the text that the wicked will be annihilated, I will go with that, because I do think this is one of the most, you know, I do think this is one of the most difficult doctrines probably of Christianity. You know, we talk about the problem of evil. I think the problem of hell, eternal hell, would be up there with things that are, you know, just really, I think, beyond us. I like what Tim Keller has said, you know, in the past. I've heard him say, you know, we're on a need to know basis. And so God's told us things, and so we need to go off what we know. And but maybe when we get there, there'll be things different. You know,
get answers to your questions. Yeah,
there'll be some things that we don't. But I guess, you know, exegetically, my argument would be, you know, Revelation 14, the fact that this is going to be a place where, you know, they have no rest day and night. Those who worship the beast and his image, you know, their smoke of their torment mm-hmm. goes up forever and ever. And the fact that that's the same language that's used at the end of Revelation 20 for, you know, Satan and the beast and the false prophet, that they have no rest day and night forever and ever. And then again, if you parallel it with Matthew 25, you know, the righteous go to eternal life, ion zoe, eternal life. And then it's directly parallel with ion kolosin, eternal punishment. And so, you know, it just seems to me that if we're going to, you know, exist forever with the Father and the Son and the Spirit in this new heavens and new earth, then it would be strange in that same verse for ion to mean some temporal place of punishment, you know, versus on forever.
The effect of it would still be atemporal. You're not going to come back to life.
Right.
But it's a tough question. I don't do much directly as far as with apologetics. So I guess I wasn't aware that you feel that it's such an acute problem, like on a par with the problem of evil. But that's interesting to me to hear you say that.
Yeah, in a way, I think it's, I mean, for me personally, I can't speak for, you know, in general. I just think for me personally, I would say it just seems like a bigger problem, the problem of evil, because the problem of evil is for sure solved. You know, if hell is eternal, then it's never solved. You know, it goes on forever. You know, the great, you know, the Amazing Grace hymn, 10,000 years, right? You know, at the end of the 10,000 years, they're still suffering in hell, you know?
Right.
So it's like that, you know, so the problem of evil is bad, but there's a solution, you know, there's a restoration, you know, every, you know, like Tolkien says in the Lord of the Rings, everything sad becomes untrue, you know. I think so you have that great hope, but the you know, again, to bring in Dante, abandon all ye hope, you who enter here, you know, that's the most terrifying thing to me. That's why I think Matthew 7:21 is probably the most terrifying passage in the Bible. Away from me, you know, you evildoers, I never knew you. That to me is to be shut out from, and again, I don't think you're shut out completely from God, because God is the one who keeps the fuel going in the lake of fire. But but you're shut out from his mercy and his grace and his love. You know, you're shut out. You're only there for his wrath and for his justice. So I, you know, in some senses, you know, scripturally, I understand it because, you know, the offense to an eternal God requires justly an eternal punishment. But I think just that the eternality of it is what is difficult.
Yeah. No. Putting it that way, I can see where you'd rank those two things together.
And if I could quote a gut, you brought up the issue of dying. This may give us all nightmares, but I find this text at the end of City of God from Augustine, one of the most profound things ever said on this, the second death, same thing as Lake of Fire. He says, "Nevertheless, with the help of the grace of our Redeemer, we may be enabled to decline or avoid that second death. For that death, which means not the separation of soul from the body, but the union of both for eternal punishment, is the more grievous death. It is the worst of all evils. There, by contrast, men will not be in the situations of before death and after death, but always in death. And for this reason, they will never be living, never dead, but dying for all eternity. In fact, man will never be in death in a more horrible sense than in that state where death itself will be deathless." That one always gets me.
Yeah, I've not heard that from Augustine before.
And it does seem to be a
tough doctrine because, you know, I don't know if I would agree with Augustine that death will be deathless because of the death of death in Revelation. But again, it goes back to the question of what does that mean? And the short answer is, I don't really know.
Yeah, and that's where I would fall. And that's where I've cut, you know, to people, especially people, again, you know, people who've had loved ones who've died, who they believe were not in Christ. You know, especially as a pastor, I've counseled them. And this is where I go with them on this kind of thing is I go, even though I'm not going to water this down. I'm not going to say
you can't give them assurance when you don't have it. You
know? Right. And I'm not going to suddenly say, oh, yeah, I'm convinced of annihilationism when I'm not. It's more of that kind of need to know that. And again, I point to just the mercy and the grace of Christ. I say, you know, if Jesus is on the throne bearing those wounds, you know, he suffered hell himself on the cross. I think, like Abraham said, will not the judge of the earth do right? You know, I completely, you know, give it all to him. I know that if Jesus is on that throne, the man who washed Judas's feet, he will do right. That's what I'm convinced of. Whatever hell is, whatever that ultimately will be, I completely trust Jesus.
Yeah, it's part of his job description, not ours.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's try to end a little bit more positively. Let's go to Abraham's bosom. This is in my notes. This is the one thing we haven't really hit on yet. But say a little bit about Luke 16 in part one. But let's focus a little bit more on the good side here with Abraham's bosom in paradise. What's your take on this, on this portion of Luke 16?
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about in part one, we talked about how Jesus is, I think, authenticating this fuller understanding of where we get seeds of it. You know, in the Old Testament, we have the righteous and the wicked going to the underworld. And then in the intertestamental time, you have, you know, 1st Enoch 22 and Josephus and some other places where there is this fuller understanding of, okay, there may be different chambers, different abodes. There may be a gulf separating where the wicked are, where the righteous are, and the experience of each is very different. And then Jesus tells this parable. And again, I think that the main point of the parable isn't to teach us this cosmic geography. I think the main point of the parable, again, is dealing with, you know, the love of money. If you read the context of Luke 16, he's telling this parable to money worshiping Pharisees, basically. And you get this image of this very rich, you know, kind of parallel to them. And he's clearly Jewish man that and at that time they would have thought this is some if anybody's. Going to be in heaven. If anybody's,
yeah,
going to
if anybody's blessed, it's this guy. Yeah.
It's going to be this guy. He had this, you know, all the pomp and circumstance with his funeral. You know, he had all this money. He's Jewish. He's a son of Abraham. And then Jesus places him in hellfire. You know, again, I said it wrong. Hades fire, because he's not in the future hell. He's in this temporal punishment. But he pictures Abraham across this gulf. In this realm that he refers to as Abraham's bosom again, I think this imagery is again, not original to Jesus. I think this is just what was a common way for the Jews to think of the good part of the next life would be you would be with the patriarchs. You know, you'd definitely be with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I think it kind of parallels what Jesus says, you know, in Matthew 8, where he talks about how, you know, we'll be seated at in the kingdom at the table with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the prophets. So to be in Abraham's bosom, hard to be in a better place than that when you die. You know, if you're where Abraham is, you know, you got it good. And so as we talked about, I think that the Hades there shouldn't be translated hell. I think the best translation would be just Hades. And maybe a note to explain what that is, because it's this temporal place of punishment that is a place for souls of the wicked. And you have, again, the cosmic geography of another place, though, a place of water. And it's really Edenic. You know, that's what's cool about it is it's, you know, even some of the church fathers, you know, use the language of the Elysian fields of the Greeks. And then the Jewish imagery, of course, would be Eden. And with Eden, you have water. You have springs of water, and this is the kind of imagery you get in the Enoch passage and in Josephus. You have, you know, it's a very Edenic-like place. And interestingly, Garden of Eden in the Greek translation of the Hebrew gets translated as paradisos. You know, this this is where paradise becomes a very, you know, theologically loaded term. The origin of it is more, you know, just parks and just, you know, beautiful parks and places of vineyards and like a walled area with fruit and all kinds of and water and springs of water and things like that. I think it goes back to the Persians and the Greeks used it this way.
Yeah, there's royalty imagery there too, even from the Old Testament and the Assyrians. I don't know what episode it was on the podcast. At one time we did an episode on Jesus as the gardener. And you know, we got into this paradise language. It's actually very interesting.
It's associated
with kingship, and you know, and the Edenic paradise, the trees, you know, the whole bit. It's one of those things it's really easy to read right over, but there's so much packed into it.
Yeah, so rich, and so just to parallel. So my argument, and this isn't an argument that a lot have made. And I think it's kind of for it to be consistent, which I think it is, it's demanded, which is paradise. I see in the New Testament as more of a adaptable state of being in the sense of this is where Christ is. This is ultimately where Jesus is paradise. And of course, it's going to have all that Edenic imagery along with it, but ultimately it's a more transferable term versus the others. And so my argument with that is basically, the thief on the cross, really the criminal on the cross, probably a guy that fought against Rome or something. He didn't just steal pears or something. So he asked Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And then Jesus gives him, like he does with all of us, he gives far more than he asked. He says, this very day, today you will be with me. And then he says, in paradise. And again, to parallel it with the descent imagery, if he really did go with Jesus that very day somewhere when they died, it would have been Abraham's bosom. It would have been so I think paradise in that text is the same as Abraham's bosom, this Edenic-like place. This criminal on the cross gets the honor of being with Jesus as he enters that realm, possibly with, again, rescuing them from there, proclaiming.
Right.
Maybe this is when he proclaimed the gospel, like 1 Peter 4 or 5 says, he proclaimed the gospel to those who are now dead. This may be that what that's talking about. And the with me part is what I think is key for paradise, because paradise is used 2 more times in the New Testament. And both times it's another distinct place, which in 2 Corinthians 12, it's the third heaven. And that's where Jesus is in that context. And then in Revelation 2, it's the ultimate, you know, fulfillment of paradise, which is the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem. So you see the transfer of the locale. But I think what's consistent about all three is that Jesus is in all three places.
Yeah. So you have him. you have him and again, the criminal, the thief, going into the afterlife, again, positive afterlife, Abraham's bosom. Again, in that afterlife place, you know, Jesus is visiting other places too.
Right.
Is that just a rough sketch of what you're saying there?
Exactly. Yeah, I think he did go other places. I don't know if he took the criminal with him to those other places.
Well, right. He's there'd be no reason to take him down to where the watchers are, and, you know, tell them they're still doomed, you know.
That's right. I think he ended up getting that awesome introduction with, you know, all the saints of old in the place of the blessed place of the underworld, and then, you know, whatever whenever they ultimately were taken, probably at the ascension, when they were all ultimately taken to the locale of heaven, that's when he would have gone there. But yeah, that would have been the first thing that they would have experienced, I think, is that. And that's why the today would be, would be literally fulfilled in that sense. And that's why I think you have to equate for Luke's understanding, when he says paradise, he is bringing in all that Edenic imagery and the hope of the Messiah to open those gates and to remove the cherubim and to let man back into paradise. And the criminal is kind of given this, you know, first, incredibly, he's given the first entrance to this place, but sees Abraham's bosom doesn't actually become paradise until Jesus is there. And that's why he says, today you will be with me in paradise. Mm-hmm. And so I like that imagery.
So
it's a way to make sense of the three different uses of the term.
Well, it would, but so you haven't found that in many commentators, or because it does help make sense of things.
I have to go back. If I did, I referenced them in the book. I know what I find a ton is even for commentators, like one of my favorite, you know, Joachim Jeremias, he wrote, you know, a lot of the TDNT articles for Paradise. He wrote it for Hades. He wrote it for the Abyss. And what's interesting, and he argues strongly, he has some great discussions on the descent, and he argues for the descent. I'm right with him on everything, but see, he says, but this seems like a contradiction because Jesus goes to paradise on this day, not the underworld. But see, if paradise is the Abraham's bosom, then it solves the problem immediately. So that's what I found a lot is, like Jeremiah's, I found people struggling with that problem, but not solving it. And that's how it makes me,
you know, when I come across stuff like that, it makes me wonder why it didn't occur to other writers, you know.
I agree. Yeah. And I'm sure other people agree with that, but there weren't many. This is a minority view. But I think if it's explained this way, then I think it should convince, you know, especially anybody who agrees with the descent, I think.
Yeah. Well, it has explanatory power. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like things that have explanatory power in more than just one place, you know, that you can get this ripple effect and build this consistency across the board. So I find that appealing.
And a great background passage, just for those in your audience, they can read, go and read the Testament of Levi. If they have, you know, if you have the Charles Worth two volumes of the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, you can, you know, grab that and look up Testament of Levi chapter 18. That's where you have this amazing passage, and that it seems to be pre-Christ that this was written. And it's talking about how the Messiah will open the gates to paradise. He will remove the barrier for man to paradise. And so Jesus fulfills, you know, that very thing.
Well, it's interesting. Before we wrap up, I do want to ask, how do you, in the course of our discussions, you know, you've I think rightly so, have corrected a lot of what people run into in their English translations. How do you usually handle that with people? I mean, do you get any pushback on that when you discuss this or other topics? I've found that, you know, sometimes people feel like they can't understand their Bibles or whatever. What note of encouragement would you give as far as, you know, being able to tap into some of this stuff, penetrate beyond the English that they have?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I teach Greek, when I've taught Greek at Dallas Seminary, many semesters, one of the things I like to say is, you know, to inspire them, to get them excited. Of course, I'm a big movie buff. I always say, you know, reading the English translations is you're going to get the main thing. You're going to get the gist. You're going to get salvation. You're going to get theology. You're going to get a full understanding of of what's going on. You know, you're not going to miss the big things if you read it, if you're only reading it in the translations, if you're only reading it, assuming you're reading, of course, a good translation. I'm not talking about the Message, of course, but as long as you're reading a good English translation, you know, you're going to get the thing. But I parallel to, like, it's more like a DVD at this point. You know, if you watch a DVD movie compared to the 4K, like if you watch Lord of the Rings on, you know, a DVD, an old DVD movie versus watching it on Blu-ray or even the 4K on HBO Max on a big screen. That would be, to me, the difference between, you know, reading the English and reading it in the original languages. When you read it in the original languages, just like on the 4K, you're starting to see things that you never saw because some of those details were so grainy that you couldn't see it as clear. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I encourage, you know, and there are a lot of ways to do it. You know, they got the Blue Letter Bible. There's a lot of ways to learn some basic concepts and basic terms, key terms.
Net Bible is available Bible. For free.
Net Bible is excellent. They're largely, you know, pretty much all their notes, as you know, are dealing with, you know, the Hebrew and the Greek. And so an excellent resource. There's so many great resources, even if you don't ever learn the original languages. But I think my main encouragement, though, is, you know, if you're reading NIV, NASB, ESV, NET, you know, if you're reading through those Bibles and you're in the Bible on a regular basis, you know, I wouldn't say you're missing anything of essential value, but you are maybe missing, like, Tartarus. You're maybe sure. These things are still important if you want to go as deep as you can to understand every jot and tittle, you know, which we do. You know, you want to understand every aspect of the scriptures and what it's teaching, the you know, to approach it and understand it as best as we can, to rightly, you know, divide the word. I think it's worth, you know, going to the original language, but I think there's, you know, there should be the encouragement that you're ultimately not missing the biggest things, of course.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, all the essentials are gonna be, you know, they're gonna be readily apparent to somebody who's, you know, a serious reader of an English Bible. You know, I always like to say the best English Bible is the one you'll actually read. But I would tend to agree with
that's right.
Your comment about paraphrases. I don't really like paraphrases.
Yeah.
Or translations that are so idiosyncratic, you know, usually done by one person, stuff like that.
And they really do show their bias. I don't like, you know, I joke about the Message, but even like the New Living Translation, a lot of people use that in churches. And I find the New Living Translation to be, in a lot of places, just really more of a paraphrase than actually.
That's because it was trying to make the Living Bible less of a paraphrase,
right.
But it's still, you know, it's still in the same turf in some respects.
And that's what I would encourage people to do, especially, you know, like we said, the note, you know, doing a good, having a good study Bible, which I think, you know, the best study Bibles out there are the NET Bible, the NET Study Bible, the ESV Study Bible, probably there's an NIV Study Bible. There's actually a King James Study Bible that I found, because it's the first time I ever went through the King James, and I found it's a scholarly version. It's got, and a lot of DTS professors were involved in it. But just that's what I would encourage, not only getting Bibles with great notes, but just reading through different translations. Don't just read through the same translation, because maybe you will miss, you know, if you only read NASB, for example, even though you're getting the goods on most everything else, you'd never know about Tartarus. 2 Peter 2:4, you'd think it was hell. And so reading different translations will open your eyes to new things. I always said, you know, when I first read the New Testament and the Old Testament in the original languages, it was like reading it almost like for the first time in a lot of ways, because I was seeing so many new things. So I think that can happen also with reading other translations.
Yeah. And the same thing will happen to you if you read the Septuagint as well. You know, there'll just be new things in there that, you know, you never would have run into before.
That's right.
Well, that's good. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and that's where they're, you know, the New Testament writers many times are drawing from the Septuagint. So I agree with someone said that, you know, the Septuagint is one of the best things to read as a background to the New Testament.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm glad we could do this again. I think our listeners will find it informative and stimulating. This is what we try to do in the podcast, to expose people to how, you know, how academics, you know, look at the Bible and how they go through it. But again, we try to get people on when we have guests, you know, who have a high view of Scripture. They do good scholarship. Again, I have a high view of the text and want to do something deliberate to try to make this information decipherable, you know, to the normal person in the pew. So thanks again for coming on.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here again with you. So thankful for your work.
Another great conversation with Dr. Bass. And I'm glad we ended it on a high note there with paradise, because the first episode and the first half of this one, you know, is doom and gloom. But at least we got some positive.
You get depressing.
Yeah. And anything else? I mean, can you give me, like you did last episode, just a quick summary of kind of what we talked about?
Yeah, well, I think it's important. Again, we talked about Gehenna and the lake of fire in Abraham's bosom, also known, also referred to as paradise here. And I think it's important, again, to recognize that Jesus is using vocabulary that's going to be familiar to his hearers. And ultimately, when it gets written down the New Testament, ultimately it's going to be known to readers. He's not just sort of freewheeling something, but he's going with what's familiar to them to communicate these ideas. And I kind of like Justin's take on link, the way he linked up Abraham's bosom and paradise there, because it does help, I think, answer the question of, you know, what happens with the thief on the cross and the descent. If you believe that Jesus actually descended into the underworld and then, you know, preached, you know, to the spirits in prison, as in 1 Peter 3, that would be the watchers, the sinning angels of Genesis 6, and then, you know, delivered sinners more generally when he rose from the dead. All this stuff can be confusing, but it can fit together. So I kind of appreciated the way he did that.
We appreciate it. It was a great conversation over both episodes. And again, please, please, please go visit our sponsor, logos.com/deckofbible. Help support the show. And we appreciate Dr. Justin Bass coming on and talking to us. And we want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.